I'm Christopher Lydon with Professor Juan Cole's broad, fresh take on the Iraq and AFPAC wars after the death of Osama bin Laden. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the global war on terror? Or, as Winston Churchill said, the end of the beginning? Or are we looking at an intermission in a permanent war? This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Our guest, Juan Cole, is a Middle East historian at the University of Michigan. He has been opening up the inside story of the Iraq War and all that followed with his own detailed daily coverage on the web. Juan Cole, your informed comment starting before the war in 2003 has always reminded me of the way Thucydides covered the Peloponnesian Wars. Smart, tough, attuned to many sources in many languages and to the eye of history. On empires and on real people. There's some sense of this whole story ending or maybe starting over after the Navy SEALs raid on the bin Laden compound in Pakistan, of all places, last week. I've been dying to start the conversation with you again. And also, while we're at it, to encompass the news of the Arab Spring. Juan Cole, make the connection between this end of Osama moment and the Arab Spring story in general. One of the striking things has been the breadth and the depth of the Muslim leadership's rejection of Osama bin Laden and the kind of news that he wasn't their guy after all.
Well, you know, Al-Qaeda was never a political force in the Arab world. It's a small fringe radical terrorist group. So the United States media, for understandable reasons in the wake of September 11th, magnified the importance of Al-Qaeda. And, you know, you see this polling that bin Laden wasn't popular and so forth. Well, of course, he was a war hero. He had fought the Soviets. And many people saw his efforts as important to the Soviet withdrawal from a Muslim country of Afghanistan, where there were elections, and there were, you know, in Lebanon and in Morocco and elsewhere in the Arab world. It wasn't ever the case that someone sympathetic to bin Laden's ideology got elected. People weren't voting for that when they could vote, and that's not where their heads were at. So this idea that there was this favorability rating for bin Laden is, you know, in the Arab world, The poor things, you know, the past 200 years have mainly been ones of colonial Western domination, and they finally mostly got rid of at least the political domination of Europe. So anytime you go to the Arab public and say, well, somebody is anti-imperialist, has stood up to the West, they'll applaud. You know, that's just what their lives have been about in the past 50 years. But it doesn't necessarily mean anything profound. Then Al-Qaeda is anti-nationalist. And, you know, although you could argue that the nation states of the Middle East are in some ways artificial, many of them have strong regional roots, and people are very proud of being Egyptian or being Tunisian, being Syrian. The language of the Arab Spring has been a language of national aspiration. It's been about the people in the secular sense of the people, and right, the French revolutionary sense of the people. It's been about the youth. And the implication is really the college-educated or high school-educated youth, the youth that knows about the ideals of the French Revolution. It's been about the nation, the whole idea of the nation state as a modern institution. So bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were talking about, you know, a United States of Islam, reviving the caliphate, erasing these national boundaries. They were talking about a puritanical lifestyle that regimented the youth. Bin Laden, you know, grabbed Coca-Cola cans out of the hands of his kids, didn't want them drinking it. So these Arab Spring revolts have been about values diametrically opposite to Al-Qaeda.
Juan Cole, you've lived in that part of the world, especially Egypt, good parts of your life. Were you prepared for the depth of the sort of self-confidence on the street in Tahrir Square and a kind of also this freedom from ideology, either Marxist or Islamist or any other, that suddenly was there, full-blown.
The political scientists have a theory about why we never predict these things. They call it a cascade. You know, there are a certain number of people who don't like the regime but won't say so. There are other people who dislike the regime enough to come out into the streets. There's a tipping point at which so many come out that the ones who just, you know, are timid but don't like it finally, you know, join in. And at that point, then you can get these enormous crowds. And if you don't quite reach the tipping point, then nothing happens. You know, the police roll it up and you don't hear anything more about it. So in both Tunisia and Egypt, then I think in Libya as well, they reached a tipping point. I did say at my weblog on January 1st of this year that the number one foreign policy challenge of the Obama administration would be Egypt. And I said, you know, Mubarak is passing from the scene. Something else is coming. There were these, I said, Facebook protests among the youth in 2008, and that there might well be an outbreak of aspirations for more democracy. And I had advised Washington against trying to stick with the old system if that happened. So I'm pretty proud of myself.
Well, you should be. Good way to start the year, man.
Yeah.
And yet, in Syria, and not to mention Libya, we've got to get to, things break so differently.
Well, you know, each of these countries has a different geopolitical makeup. Egypt and Tunisia are distinctive in not having strong ethnic divides. So, you know, you could have a revolution in Tunisia or Egypt of this sort where a leader was overthrown without the rest of the people being worried about who would come in his stead. Would it be some other ethnic group that might then take advantage of them or disadvantage them? In Syria, you know, you have 10% of the country is Christian, 10% is Alawite Shiite. You have Druze and then various kinds of Sunni. You have the more hardline Salafi fundamentalists. You have Sufis. So it's a quite different situation than the one you have in Egypt and Tunisia.
This makes the Arab Spring so hard to score, but also to deal with emotionally, because for every variation in their societies, we have a kind of variation in the American response. We were slow sort of getting aboard the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions, and it's got various positions on various other places. The question is, how many double standards can we cope with in our head? We look at the Saudis and we look at Israel with respect to Gaza in sort of one untouchable group. We look at Libya at the sort of the other end. We're really embroiled in a war there. We're looking at Syria with a certain caution. But how do we handle this in our own heads, that we're viewing each of these different phenomena so differently?
Well, I would argue that the Obama administration in many ways harkens back to Bush Sr.'s foreign policy ideals, which were those of the realist school. I think Obama is, you know, he's not a classical realist in the sense that he does have a sense of morality in a way that I think maybe Henry Kissinger does not. But the realist school posits that great powers act according to their interests, not according to namby-pamby ideals, and that, moreover, they ought to act according to their interests. If they don't, it messes up the world. And it sort of would be like a corporation trying not to make money. So in every instance, the Obama administration's stance has been what would be in the interest of the United States. It hasn't been an idealistic or moralistic stance. And I think it's a reaction against the muscular Wilsonianism of the Bush administration, which was very gung-ho to democratize the Middle East at the point of a gun. So, yes, you know, the Obama administration really had very little to do with Tunisia. It was a French sphere of influence, but they said almost nothing about the unfolding events there while they were happening. And, you know, at the end of it, when Ben Ali left, Obama wished the Tunisian people well. That was about the extent of it. In Egypt, where the United States has very serious interests, you know, 10% of world trade goes through the Suez Canal. Egypt is key to U.S. Geopolitical commitments in the region, as you say, to both Saudi Arabia and Israeli security. So the initial response of the Obama administration in Egypt was to support Mubarak. Joe Biden came out and said, well, you know, I don't think it would be fair to call him a dictator.
Right.
Hillary Clinton told us that she was sure the regime was stable.
And Frank Wisner said, you know, we need him just the way he is.
Yeah. So it was only when it was quite clear after weeks of demonstrations and after the army had already said that it wouldn't intervene that Obama called Mubarak and said, here, see here, old man, you're going to have to go. And so the administration was dragged kicking and screaming into this outcome. It wasn't their preferred one. And they also did try to see what they could do to maneuver their clients like Omar Suleiman into power in the aftermath, which I think they largely failed in.
Reconcile our stances with Syria on one hand and Gaddafi in Libya on the other. I mean, what is our position on sort of naked thugism?
Yeah. Well, in the case of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, they get a pass, as you said, just because they're geopolitically so important to the administration. In Syria, with which the United States already had bad relations, in part because of the influence of the Israel lobby in Washington, it was very easy for the U.S. to condemn the crackdown in Syria and then to impose financial sanctions. In Libya, my own reading is that Washington didn't want to get involved in Libya. Again, it was a realist calculation. There weren't strong U.S. interests there. And so I think Obama and Gates would have been perfectly happy to, or not happy, but they would have been willing to see the protest movement in Libya crushed if that's what happened. But I think there, the Saudis, the British, the French, other allies were insistent that Gaddafi had to go.
Juan Cole, you were insistent that Gaddafi had to go, and you backed not only intervention, but you still back use of drones in Libya if as necessary. Explain why you thought it was so important.
Well, you know, I'm a progressive internationalist. I think one of the things that's wrong with the world is that we have laws inside nations, but when it comes to international affairs, we have a jungle. The strong kill the weak and eat them. And what the United Nations was about in 1945 forward was supposed to be the attempt to craft an international order that was founded on law. Gaddafi is not allowed to roll up 30 tanks and fire live shells into the midst of a peaceful demonstration. That's a crime against humanity. And there ought to be sanctions for it. I think much of Libya had gone out of his hands before he rolled the tanks and used artillery, cluster bombs, the most horrible kinds of munitions on civilians who were simply asking for the right to demonstrate peacefully, which is what they were mainly doing. You know, when the Arab League asked for a UN resolution, and when the United Nations Security Council asked that there be an international intervention to prevent Gaddafi from going on with his crimes against humanity, I thought that was a great good thing. And it is an exact contrast to the Iraq War.
I was just going to say, make the contrast.
Well, the Iraq War, first of all, in Libya you had an imminent humanitarian disaster, right? Gaddafi was actively killing people. He was about to take over Benghazi, the center of the rebellion.
And a pretty bad scene in Baghdad, too.
No, not in 2002. I'm thinking about this in legal terms. If you were walking in the street and you saw somebody beating up somebody else, you actually have a legal obligation to intervene. And that's, you know, the last episode of Seinfeld was about the selfishness of not intervening in such a situation. So there was no imminent humanitarian crisis in Iraq at that point in 2002. Then, in addition to which, there was no international consensus about an intervention. There was no United Nations Security Council resolution demanding an intervention. You know, it's illegal to go to war, except under two conditions. One is self-defense, and that didn't apply between the United States and Iraq. And the other is that there be a United Nations Security Council resolution asking for an intervention on humanitarian or international order grounds. That also did not exist in Iraq. So I think a lot of people of my readers and so forth have misunderstood me to just be an ordinary, everyday leftist anti-imperialist, so whatever the West does is wrong. It's not that. I'm a progressive internationalist. I want a rule of law to obtain in international affairs. So the Iraq war was illegal every which way from Sunday. The Libyan intervention is both legal and legitimate. It's entirely justified.
Does it seem to you to be working?
It's too soon to tell. People are so impatient. You know, an intervention from the air is a very difficult thing. It's not the first time it's been tried. It was done in Bosnia and Kosovo. And, you know, from the time that the intervention began in Kosovo until Milosevic was arrested by his own people and turned over to the International Court in The Hague was 2 years. So, you know, a few weeks doesn't tell you anything. I think if the 28 nations of NATO and the 22 nations of the Arab League wants Gaddafi not to be there, over time he won't be.
To what extent, I mean, given the kinds of varieties of experience on the ground, to what extent is there something you'd identify as the Arab Spring, an Arab revolt, a connected movement still happening?
Well, it's simply the exercise of people power, especially by the youth, by the high school and college educated youth, to overthrow a very narrow, manipulative and exploitative elite. You know, the Qaddafis are a perfect example. There's no real difference between Libya's oil money and the Qaddafi's family fortune. These sons of Qaddafi are spoiled billionaire brats. One of them was arrested for drunkenly driving 90 miles an hour up and down the Champs-Élysées and almost killing people. He was arrested in Switzerland. He and his wife were arrested for beating their Tunisian and Moroccan servants within an inch of their life while staying at this $17,000 a night chalet. I mean, this is expropriation of the national wealth on the part of this clan of the Qaddafis. And, it's, you know, people in Benghazi and Beni Walid didn't have proper housing. I mean, it's an oil country. People should be well off, but they weren't because the money was just being scooped up, invested abroad, and for the benefit of this very narrow elite in Tripoli. So what people are saying is we're not going to put up with that anymore. This sliver of billionaire cronies is not going to be allowed to run our governments, to censor us, to interfere in our educational and our occupational opportunities, to distort our national economies. We're going to come out in the streets until they're gone.
I wonder, though, is the movement in general threatened by being blocked in Syria specifically, for example? Would that set back the whole wave?
It's possible. I mean, I certainly think that the success of the Tunisians inspired the Egyptians. It proved that that the model worked, that this people power could get rid of the tyrant. And Egypt and Tunisia, in turn, inspired Yemen and Syria. And so we're the movement to have a significant failure. It might make people in Algeria, for instance, think twice about trying it.
Do you like the progress of democracy in Egypt so far?
It's fairly very early days. I mean, there certainly is. There's more civil freedom in Egypt than there was 3 months ago. But we have to see who wins the parliamentary elections. What laws they pass. We have to see who wins the presidency. Probably there's going to be a two-year process of drafting a new constitution. At the moment, all we know is that the Mubarak's were a logjam. They were getting in the way of Egypt's national development. The logjam has been removed. So now the river can flow more freely. but we don't know in what direction.
And yet there are little things that make sort of big waves. Just the thought that Egypt will, of course, have a new relationship to Gaza. The thought that Egypt is pleased and is encouraging this new partnership in the West Bank between Hamas and Fatah. These are considered to be shocking and maybe even threatening developments, when in fact they seem perfectly inevitable. How should we get ready for these things? How do we help Israel get ready for these changes?
Well, I think the hardline right-wing parties who are in power in Israel are going to have to accommodate themselves to the new reality that they now live in a region in which public opinion matters. It didn't matter. It didn't matter last year. It's increasingly clear that the Mubareks, perhaps some of the high officers, were personally bribed by the Israelis or their American backers to adopt policies that were not in Egypt's best interest.
Right.
It's being alleged that the deal to sell Israel Egyptian natural gas at below market prices was a piece of corruption. And it seems clear from the State Department cables released by WikiLeaks that Omar Suleiman, the former head of Egyptian military intelligence, who was the point man for dealing with the Palestinians, you know, there was no daylight between him and the Likud party on policy. He actively, I think, tried to keep the Palestinians divided. He actively attempted to blockade the civilian population of Gaza. And these were policies that were pathological, certainly against international law, and which were deeply, deeply unpopular with the Egyptian people. Mm. But it didn't matter because they were living in a dictatorship. So the end of the crony billionaire regime, the rise of people power and the meaningfulness of popular opinion is such that the civilian population of Gaza simply is not going to be any longer denied basic staples so as to punish them for having voted for Hamas. And the policy whereby they can't export whatever they manufacture or make that the Israelis have imposed on them, which has reduced so many of them to dire poverty.
Right.
That the Egyptians simply aren't going to cooperate with those kinds of policies anymore.
But the Israeli imposition and the calm and quiet sleep that came with it came to seem like a birthright in Israel and was taken entirely for granted. And it's a shock even to imagine it disappearing. How does Israel deal with this changed reality?
Well, so far, you know, what would be necessary is simply adjustment of some policies. At the moment, you know, Israeli settlements on the West Bank, which is Palestinian territory, and the colonization of it is illegal, those settlements are being expanded. And there's no prospect that the Egyptians would be able to stop that process. I think Egypt, the new Egypt, will support the Palestinians' bid for recognition as a state at the UN General Assembly in September. And once the Palestinians are widely recognized as a state, and not just by, you know, small, out-of-the-way third world countries, but by the European Union and most of South America and so forth, they'll begin to be able to have standing to sue. So I think over time, international law and order, which again, you know, is my hope for the future, will be deployed in the interest of the Palestinians. And the real problem with the Palestinians is that they, contrary to the intent of the League of Nations, they have been denied a statehood, and they have been denied in many cases, and in millions of cases, citizenship. So they are flying Dutchmen. They have no they have no citizenship rights. And a person in the modern world without citizenship in a state is vulnerable, is open to predatory practices. And if their property is usurped, they have no law court to seek justice in. So the whole Palestinian nation is stateless and without citizenship, and therefore without basic rights or basic human dignity. It's a crime. It's a blot on humanity for the situation to go on like this.
Can you imagine any force in Israel effectively anticipating this change, getting into negotiations sooner rather than later about the Palestinian issue?
At the moment, no. The Israeli parties who happen to be in power are quite rigid and unyielding on these issues. I think it's entirely possible that the changing political, geopolitical environment will provoke some kind of crisis and that the Netanyahu government may fall over its inability to act in Israel's interests, its unwillingness to do so. I think there are other more pragmatic Israeli leaders who might come to the fore. But, you know, one sympathizes with the Israelis in the sense that they were genocided by the Europeans and then shunted off to this garrison state surrounded by 300 million angry Arabs. And they really feel, you know, a kind of a floating fortress on the fringes of the Middle East. And so when they're challenged, their backs get up for understandable reasons. And their first instinct is not to seek a political compromise. And I think that history, that trauma that causes them to adopt a more belligerent iron wall kind of strategy will serve them poorly in dealing with a new democratizing Middle East where the young people are insistent on the implementation of human rights and democratic ideals.
Speaking of pragmatic politicians, retake the measure of our president, Barack Obama. How's he handling all this?
Well, Obama, with regard to the Arab world, I think, you know, had a rude shock in the sense that Washington considered places like Egypt not to be a problem for U.S. foreign policy.
Or
they had worked out a cozy deal with Yemen. Even Syria, you know, they had bad relations with it, but Obama had sent for the first time in some time an ambassador, and there was hopes of engagement. So the Obama approach, as I said, was a realist approach. You know, Kissinger said that diplomacy is a game that you play with the pieces on the board. And that's, you know, the opposite of the neoconservative Bushian doctrine that if you don't like the pieces on the board, you invade and change them. So the Obama approach had been to deal with the region as it is, to engage with enemies, to depend on friends. And now everything has been thrown up in the air. The part of the Middle East that they thought was nailed down is not. It's in motion. It's fluid. It's challenging. And they had put all of their efforts on the Eastern Front in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that they've been behind the curve. But they at least haven't made any major stumbles, any major errors. I think there's a lot of goodwill towards the United States now in the Arab world, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and in Libya. Chris, in Benghazi, they're waving American flags. You've been watching this region,
of course,
for a long time. Have we ever seen them waving American flag?
It's astonishing.
You know, this is the kind of thing that the Bushies promised us would happen in Iraq.
Yeah, candy.
But which did not happen. Yeah. And my friends who were there in spring of 2003 said you couldn't imagine the hostility with which ordinary everyday Iraqis watched those U.S. troops trod on their soil. But in Libya, there actually is this change of mind, I think, among a lot of people towards the United States. And the intervention, although it's unpopular among the American left, is widely popular in the Arab world. So I think they've done all right.
Not to get too deep into detailed personality, but what do you make of the shift at the top of the Obama security team, General Petraeus and Leon Panetta?
Here I share the misgivings a lot of my friends and contacts in U.S. Intelligence and security agencies that, you know, the purpose of the director of the CIA is to second-guess policy, is to take what the analysts and the operatives on the ground are sending up that might challenge the cozy orthodoxies of the White House and the Washington establishment and to stick to their guns. You know, an intelligence operative who tells the government what the government wants to hear is called a weasel. General Petraeus is somebody that I admire and who I think has important accomplishments, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. But he's very wedded to this counterinsurgency strategy. Of course, he wrote the book on it.
Right.
And I think it's in Afghanistan, it is a foolhardy strategy. I think it's very unlikely to succeed, even by the criteria that Petraeus himself set forth. And then to have him head the CIA at a time when that policy may well face very significant challenges, might need to be rethought, is awkward.
Different topic. Nobody much talks about Iran anymore, but I wonder, to the extent that Iran won the Iraq war, has Iran lost the Arab Spring?
The Iranians, you know, the Iranian foreign policy towards the Arab Spring is just like the American. It's a realist foreign policy.
Hmm.
And it has the same contradictions and hypocrisies that you pointed to with regard to Washington. So they're opposed to the uprising in Syria, in Iran. Why? Because the regime of Bashar al-Assad is an ally of Iran.
Right.
They supported the uprising in Libya, but not the Western intervention there. But of course, without the Western intervention and the Arab intervention, the uprising would have been crushed. So that's a contradiction. It's kind of Iranian realism. There's no rhyme or reason to it, and it's just whatever is in Tehran's interest.
They're not driving the game, though, or driving even the conversational agenda as they were even 6 months ago.
Well, I don't think they were ever very important in the conversation in the Arab world.
Really?
Nobody paid attention to the Iranians in the Arab world. No, Chris, you know, if you read Arabic newspapers, it's very interesting the way they organize themselves. So the front page is for national news, and then the second and third pages would be for Arab world news.
Hmm.
And then you'd come the fourth page to international news. And Turkey and Iran would be in the same category as Singapore and China. They're not part of the Arab world. It's not the way the news is organized. And I think that those newspaper organizations represent the way of thinking in the Arab world. So Iran was irrelevant. Nobody in they're Sunni Arabs, just, you know, in the Arab world mostly, and they're not interested in having their clergy rule them, which is the Iranian model. And then the Iranians are Persian, you know, they have all kinds of history and culture that's different.
But they also were said to scare the wits out of the Saudis, to the point that the Saudis would have, you know, even encouraged us or Israel to whack them.
What I meant was that, you know, the United States tended to build Iran up as some kind of a major threat in the region and major geopolitical threat in the world. And, you know, Fareed Zakaria pointed out that Iran's defense budget is kind of, you know, like that of Norway or Singapore. And it's just nobody can remember the last time it invaded a country. And Iran just was never likely to be a geopolitical hegemon. Its economy is not doing that great. It's mainly got petroleum working for it. Turkey was the one that was much more likely to be influential in the Arab world than Iran.
And people wonder about Turkey's playing its cards and its position in this new world. What do you think?
Well, Turkey, like the United States, has been thrown for a loop by all of these developments. And it's too soon to see exactly how they would shake out. Mm. Turkey, for many decades, had been hoping to be part of Europe, had been a NATO member, and had bad relations with Arab nationalist regimes. In some ways, Turkey was born as a reaction against the rise of Arab nationalism. But since 2002, with the rise of the Justice and Development Party, the Turkish government has done a lot of outreach to the Arab world, has repaired relations with places like Syria, and has seen a vast increase in its trade with the region. Mm. So trade with the Middle East is now something close to 25% of Turkey's external trade, and it was 12% in 2002. Yeah. So it's doubled, and this you're talking about billions and billions of dollars in trade. So all of this turmoil in Syria, in many ways is very unwelcome to Turkey, and they're not happy about al-Assad's crackdown. Of course, the Turks are mostly Sunnis, and so they have some sympathy with the Sunni towns like Dera that are protesting. And they have invited Syrians to Istanbul for consultations about a compromise. But they mainly invited the fundamentalist parties and leaders, which angered al-Assad.
One call, I have a last question of a sort of personal nature, but it's about Edward Said. He's on my mind all through this Arab Spring, and I keep wondering what he would have made for it. I think of him in hindsight as a very large anti-imperial spirit, a kind of Arab nationalist, but a anti-war, anti-ideological figure. What would Edward Said be making of all this, and what would he be worrying about in the good news?
Well, Edward was never a doctrinaire person. He wrestled his way through ethical and moral issues in a way that I admire and I try to emulate. He came out against Saddam Hussein's occupation of Kuwait in the Gulf War, and implicitly supported the liberation of Kuwait. And he, of course, as you say, stood for decency and democracy in the Middle East, something that I think he worked for in his own way. And my own guess is that Said would have been there in Tahrir Square holding a placard, that he would have been enormously cheered by these developments. I miss the incisiveness, the elegance of his voice at this moment. We were robbed of it by his death.
Very well said. One call, it's just such a privilege to be able to sort of cover the waterfront with you. And I just got to say again from the heart, I regard your website, Informed Comment, as one of the great gifts of the internet, that a voice like yours, as independent, as learned, as erudite, as fair, as sort of a work in progress, can speak to millions of people on this whole vast area. Thank you. Thank you for your work every day. And thank you for joining us on Open Source.
Chris, it's great to be on with you, and I'm so grateful for your kind words. And just to note that not everybody agrees.
Well, you wouldn't want them to agree, all of them.
Yeah.
One call, thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.